At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A day off from their labors. That's how many Americans will mark the holiday today. But for millions of the unemployed, every day is an unwanted day off and a search for income and answers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Labor Day Monday. It is the 6th day of September. We mark this holiday by noting that there are millions of people in this country who wish they were laboring. We have the highest unemployment rate for Labor Day in almost 30 years. Labor Day 1982 saw a 10.1% jobless rate. Today, it's 9.6. In the midst of a so-called jobless recovery and just 2 months before a midterm election, President Barack Obama was in Milwaukee today, endorsing another $50 billion in government infrastructure projects.
I want America to have the best infrastructure in the world. We used to have the best infrastructure in the world. We can have it again.
After last year's $800 billion in stimulus money, there are questions about whether another spending program is the best strategy. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
The president wants to pay for the new projects by ending a tax break for oil and gas companies. White House officials concede the jobs won't be created until next year at the earliest, but that's an indication the president is listening to economists who say it's time to shift focus to long-term job creation. Howard Rosen is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
At this point, we need to switch our strategies from stimulating consumption to stimulating investment.
Rosen says cutting income taxes and offering tax credits for things like child care or buying a home may have helped stop the slide into recession, but they're no good for creating stable employment. Now he says it's time to get companies to build new factories and equipment.
So investment tax credit, maybe speeding up some depreciation allowances, research and development tax credits.
But investment-based tax credits will only get you so far, says Robert Shapiro, a Commerce Undersecretary in the Clinton administration.
They won't drive recovery in themselves because ultimately business requires strong demand in order to justify investment, whether or not it's tax preferred.
He recommends creating more support for housing prices, which will make consumers more confident about spending. Still, later this week, the president is expected to announce several more investment-based tax breaks, a permanent extension of the research and development tax credit, and possibly a temporary elimination of payroll taxes paid by employers. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Even in the digital age, we're still using paper. And sometimes we need multiple versions of what's on that paper. So we Xerox it. We copy it. But apparently that little name drop is not enough for the company that is synonymous with copying. This week, Xerox will launch its largest advertising campaign in decades to let all of us know that it's about more than just making copies. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Xerox, like Google, FedEx, and even TiVo is a company name turned verb, as in, let me just go Xerox these expense reports. Name recognition like that might seem like a marketer's dream, but it's actually a bit of a rub for Xerox. Copying just isn't as sexy or relevant as it used to be. Krista Carone is with the company.
We understand that there is pretty entrenched perceptions of Xerox in the printing or the copier space.
Carone says the current brand perception is useful. It opens doors. Xerox wants people to recognize that it now provides all sorts of back office services, like scanning and document management. Earlier this year, Xerox acquired Affiliated Computer Services in a more than $6 billion deal.
They're putting their money where their mouth is.
Angèle Boyd is an analyst with IDC. She thinks Xerox could pull off a brand makeover, and the marketing campaign will help.
Too often companies make the mistake of assuming if we build it, they will come.
But branding consultant Rob Frankel isn't convinced. He says Xerox's past attempts at transformation haven't worked all that well.
Advertising will raise brand awareness, but if people don't understand why they should care about the brand, then it's going to fail.
He thinks there are a couple hurdles for Xerox. It's got to convince people it does more than make copiers. It also has to explain its new services and convince potential clients that it does them best. That's a tall order for any marketing campaign. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
No trading on Wall Street today, so we'll have details of what happened in non-holiday markets when we do the numbers. It may be Labor Day in this country, but in other parts of the world, it is no Labor Day. Unions all over France have called for a strike to begin tonight over the government's plans to raise the retirement age from 60 to 62. More than a million public employees in South Africa suspended a four-week-long strike over pay raises and housing subsidies. And millions of commuters are facing travel chaos in London. Workers on the subway system there, called the Tube, walked off the job today. Joining us with the details is our European Bureau Chief, Stephen Beard. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Tess.
So what impact is this strike having on London? Is the capital crippled at this point?
Not yet. The key group of workers, the train drivers and the signalers and the station staff, walked out quite late this evening. So the full effect won't be felt until tomorrow morning's rush hour and the evening rush hour. London, at least, has had plenty of warning, and the Tube managers and travellers have been making preparations.
And how have they been preparing then, if they've had all this warning time?
Well, the transport authorities have laid on 100 extra buses. They've chartered extra riverboats to ferry 10,000 people up and down the Thames. People have been urged to go to work by bike. There'll be special escorted bike routes across the city. And if previous Tube strikes are anything to go by, we'll see a lot of people on roller skates in London tomorrow. and a lot of people walking. But are they going to beat the strike? I doubt it. 3.5 million people use the Tube every day. This strike is going to cause major disruption.
And at some economic cost, I would assume. Do we know how hard that might hit the London economy?
Difficult to get a precise figure, but the London Chamber of Commerce reckons it's going to cost London businesses $75 million. That's for a one-day strike.
That is a lot of coin. Stephen, tell us what the strike is about there. Is it pay? Is it working conditions? Something else?
It's about job cuts. The Tube management want to shed 800 station staff positions. These are jobs for people mostly in ticket offices. Getting rid of these jobs would save around $25 million a year. Now, many of the workers involved in this dispute say there's a bigger picture at work here. Union organiser Steve Headley says these job cuts are part of the new austerity. He says all public sector workers should resist.
The government was planned 25% cuts in the public sector are the people that are going to cause misery, not only in the railway industry, but right across the piece. And workers better get up and get organised and get behind us and get organised in their own trade unions, because this government's determined to dismantle the welfare state and we've got to stop them.
Now, the man who's ultimately responsible for the operation of the tube is the London mayor, Boris Johnson. He says the strike is politically motivated and doesn't have the support of many Londoners.
Quite frankly, I think almost everybody in London understands that at a time of very difficult financial squeeze, you need to make essential reforms.
If this dispute is not resolved, there'll be another 24-hour strike every 4 weeks on the tube until December. You could call this, though, Britain's first austerity strike. And as the government prepares this fall to spell out all the details of its budget cuts, there could be many more of these disruptions in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, Stephen, I would ask how you're getting to work, but I know you live out in the lovely countryside, so not a problem.
I've always got my roller skates.
Sounds good. Stephen Beard, thanks so much.
Okay, Tess.
One of the ways unemployed workers here in the U.S. are trying to get back into the game is by attending job fairs. But these events have changed along with the jobs picture. We sent Andrea Gardner to a fair in Southern California, and she discovered there are still opportunities, but not the kind many job seekers are hoping for.
The Long Beach Hilton is swarming with people. They carry resumes and straighten their suit jackets. Many are hoping to land a traditional 9-to-5 job, but instead they're finding mostly sales jobs that pay on commission. At one booth, a representative from a direct sales company is showing women how to make money selling products in their homes. At another, State Farm Insurance is promoting an independent contractor program where agents sell policies on commission. Some trade schools have booths too, hoping job seekers sign up for classes.
Jobs are very scarce.
Peggy Hillman works for National Career Fairs, which organized the event. Last year, it canceled some job fairs across the country because so few businesses were hiring. 2010 has picked up, thanks in part to alternative opportunities like these.
People are becoming more and more inventive about how they're going to make an income, and those kind of opportunities work for some people.
John Diamond is here recruiting distributors for his company, Kongen Water. It sells water treatment units for homes and businesses. He says many of the people he meets haven't come to grips with the new employment market. Either that, or they don't want to pay $4,000 for a water unit. All distributors are required to buy one up front or pay one off through sales.
I don't have the clock in at 9 and clock out at 5 job anymore. And those job opportunities aren't here, and they're disappointed. You're disappointed in what the reality is.
Diamond says too many job seekers leave empty-handed, preferring to wait for a full-time job in their current trade rather than trying something new. Pat Stevens is among the 500 or so people here. She's hoping to find a full-time secretarial job, but hasn't found any leads. She says commission sales jobs are too great a risk right now.
Somebody has to buy in order for anybody to make any money, and nobody can depend on that, especially in this economy. Where are they getting the money? Everybody's broke.
But not all job seekers were quite as skeptical. Lou Giordani and Vaskin Bajian left the career fair with several brochures.
We're IT engineers, and we're definitely having to look outside the box. So, yeah, we're considering sales positions, opening up businesses, whatnot. Definitely something different than what we're normally doing. And nowadays, you got to go with what's available.
Giordani says he'll likely sell computer products on commission. It could either be a temporary way to make money or the start of his next career. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Lots of folks will be barbecuing in the great outdoors today. Last unofficial weekend of summer, time to use up those briquettes. But if you are going out to dinner, get ready for some flashbulbs to go with your appetizer and your main course, and probably dessert too. Food blogs and review sites are all the rage these days, and they've spawned some new behavior at restaurants that would probably have Emily Post rolling over in her grave. Sally Herships has our story from New York.
It's Thursday night. I'm at Fatty Q, a trendy barbecue joint in Brooklyn. I'm here with Hagen Blount, Lawrence Weibman, and Andy Friedman. Three big, hungry guys trying to decide what to get for dinner.
The crab laksa, the spare ribs, and the brisket.
They spend a while debating their order.
I would be interested in the cucumbers.
But when the food finally comes, no one touches it. instead of attacking their plates, they're photographing them, which isn't easy because it's kind of dark in here.
Have you been using the 2-second delay?
1 second.
Yeah, 1 second delay.
Ever since you told me it's Ankichi.
Hagen, Blount, and Weidman are going to post the photos online, along with a review of the restaurant. That's because they're food bloggers, or, depending on who you ask, food paparazzi. And Weidman's not very fond of the term.
The idea of paparazzi definitely has a negative connotation to it, almost like, you know, a shoe fly. And what we're doing here, me, is out of passion. We love food.
But whether you call them paparazzi or bloggers, they're showing up in restaurants more often, bringing cameras and sometimes even tripods along with their appetite. Like at Cafe Flora, a vegetarian restaurant in Seattle. Nat Stratton Clark is the owner. For the most part, he's very happy with the free publicity.
This wonderful woman from Dallas came in last week, and she is gluten-free, and the only reason that she knew about us is because she typed in gluten-free Seattle, and up came this picture that somebody had taken.
But sometimes the quality of the photos doesn't match the quality of the food. They can be underexposed or taken mid-meal, bite marks and all. Katie Greco is VP of Operations and New Projects at Kraft Restaurants in New York. We sat down to take a look at some of the pictures bloggers have posted of 3-star meals from celebrity chef Tom Colicchio.
I think they're horrible looking, aren't they? I mean, you tell me, but like if I were to look at that picture, I wouldn't think that looks particularly appetizing. And that was a good review.
But Greco isn't that concerned with the pictures themselves. Instead, she says, the bigger problem is the possibility of bloggers disrupting the ambiance with flashes or tripods and disturbing diners trying to enjoy their meals in peace. The average check at Kraft is about $100.
When people are playing a high price tag, the expectations are often just as high, if not higher.
Trendy eateries like New York City's Momofuku Co. and Le Caprice have banned photography altogether, and Kraft doesn't allow photographers to use a flash. But Greco's biggest beef with bloggers is their potential lack of experience. She doesn't want amateur food writers influencing people's dining decisions.
When you feel like they're having that influence without really knowing what they're talking about, it's very frustrating.
Back at Fatty Q, food blogger Lawrence Weidman tells me he understands. Sort of.
But in the end, if a chef is making good food, he or she has nothing to worry about because it speaks for itself.
You know that old saying, everyone's a critic? Well, for restaurant owners, it's truer than ever. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
How is it?
Delicious. That is some pretty awesome pork goodness right there, I'm telling you.
Coming up, can't unwind at the end of the night? Try one of these.
Vacation in a bottle, Mary Jane's tea, and dream water.
Say hello to anti-energy drinks. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. stock markets took the day off today, but traders were busy elsewhere around the globe. Riding a bounce from Friday's rally on Wall Street, Japan's Nikkei index surged 187 points, more than 2%, to close at 93.01. The news was equally upbeat in Europe. The German DAX added 20 points, a third of a percent, to settle at 61.55. In Paris, the CAC 40 tacked on 12 points, a third of a percent, to end at 36.84. And in London, the FTSE index edged up 11 points, 0.2%, to close at 54.39. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRowePrice.com. American Public Media presents Marketplace Minute, supported by Yellow Book 360. Tune in every Friday for Bill Radke's poetic take on the week's news in 60 seconds. Available at Marketplace.org. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Date Book, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, First Lady Michelle Obama hosts ballet, modern, and hip-hop performers for the White House Dance Series. It was on this day 2 years ago that mortgage finance companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were rescued by the U.S. government. And speaking of surviving, singer Gloria Gaynor turned 61. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. The internet security firm Panda Labs recently released a list of the biggest scams of the last decade. Those emails from Nigeria topped the rankings. So did the beautiful young girl from Russia who needs money for travel expenses to America. And then there are the fake job offers that convince you to give over your bank account details. In this great recession, it is easier than ever for desperate folks to fall for these ploys. Cheryl Harris writes about scams, scammers, and the people they scam for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. I asked her how it is that in 2010, anybody still holds out some belief that these tricks are real.
The fact is, there are some really low-hanging kind of scams that are obvious kinds of scams.
The Nigerian banker.
We've all heard of the Nigerian banker. But the fact is, the way these scams work, the way they're packaged, can be much more sophisticated.
Can you give us an example of that?
This is from one of my readers. She had a house and she was letting out a room. She heard from a woman who said she was in London. She said, oh, I'm coming to school in Cleveland. This room sounds perfect for me. There was a lot of back and forth emails. And the girl sent a deposit, check for the deposit, and the first few months of rent. And shortly after that, the girl contacted her back and said, my father has been in a terrible accident. I can't come to school anymore. I need that money back to help take care of him. Please keep the deposit. Please send me back my rent money. Well, what kind of human could hear a plea like that?
Of course.
And not do it. And lo and behold, the check turned out to be fake.
Uh-oh.
All of these scams have in common that you get a check and you're asked to deposit it. Any ordinary person thinks, when that money shows up in your bank account, the check has cleared.
Right.
That is not the case. What happens is the bank is responsible to get you your money within a certain amount of time, the money from your checks that you deposit.
Mm-hmm.
It meant they're coming up against their deadline, so they're making that money available to you. When they find out that check is counterfeit, they take the money back out of your account.
I understand that also that this is not just a cautionary tale for individuals, but corporations can get caught up in these kinds of scams.
Yes, they can. And there are hundreds of law firms across the country.
Law firms?
You get an email from Asia and it says, we're a big company here. We do a lot of business with companies in the United States. And some of them are not paying us. So we would like to hire your firm to represent our interests there, collect our money. But they'll contact the law firm again and say, you know, one of the companies has actually agreed to go ahead and issue us a check. And since you're handling our interests there anyway, we're going to have them send it to you. You deduct your retainer, just wire us the rest at this bank. And I'm not talking little money either. I'm talking about $200,000, $300,000, $500,000. Oh. These are huge scams.
I want to ask you real quickly about another common scam that happens, the work-at-home schemes. You'll see flyers on telephone poles. You'll see it advertised on the internet. And you think, you know what? Sounds easy. I need some money right now, so I'm going to go ahead and do it. What are those?
A lot of those are the old check scam that we just talked about.
They're
being asked to become an agent of this overseas company in the United States, set up the bank account, receive checks from all over, deposit those, and then wire the proceeds over after they deduct their pay.
It sounds like I can't trust anybody.
You certainly have to be cautious about who you trust.
Cheryl Harris is the consumer columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Thanks so much for coming in.
Sure thing. Thank you so much.
If you've got the day off today, you don't have to worry about having too much to do and not enough energy. But on days when that particular problem arises, you can always make a run to Starbucks or some other shop peddling coffee, or hit one of those vending machines offering a rainbow of energy drinks and sodas. But what happens when you want to come down? Caitlin Carroll tells us there's a new product that promises instant relaxation in a bottle.
After a long day of loading up on caffeine, sometimes the only way to relax is to have a drink. No, not that kind of drink.
Mary Jane's Relaxing Soda is a relaxation drink that has kava in it.
Kava root supposedly relaxes you, like that other kind of Mary Jane. Matt Moody created the drink last year after losing his job at a nutritional supplement company. Moody's drinks are among the more than 20 downer drinks on the market now. Drinks like Vacation in a Bottle, Drank, and Dream Water. They contain supplements such as melatonin, valerian root, or tryptophan. You know, the stuff that knocks you out after Thanksgiving dinner. Gary Hemphill is with the research firm Beverage Marketing Corporation.
Well, what we know is that today's consumers will buy beverages for reasons other than refreshment.
Like to help them stay awake. The market for energy drinks is worth about $4 billion a year. But Hemphill says sales of relaxation drinks are still small, only around $20 million.
There is an education process with consumers to basically teach them what the product is.
And the high-octane approach of energy drinks like Red Bull and Rockstar isn't really an option.
So we can't drive around in big monster trucks.
Matt Moody from Mary Jane Soda.
We have to drive around in Mini Coopers and stuff like that. Something a little bit quieter.
Consumers are willing to spend to get some sleep. They already drop around $12 billion a year on pills, gadgets, and bedding designed to help them get rest. But do these new drinks work? Hard to know. The FDA doesn't regulate the drink makers' claims. Dr. Alon Avedon is from UCLA's sleep clinic.
We don't know what is being marketed, whether the dose in these drinks is really an effective dose.
So to see if any of these drinks actually induce sleep, I turned to my colleagues at Marketplace. I started with overnight producer Ethan Lindsay.
Jim and Carol.
Do you have 2 minutes?
Yeah.
I tracked Ethan down at the coffee machine, where he spends a lot of his time.
Did you try the relaxation drink? Which one did you have?
The shot, the chill shot, the eye chill.
Did the drink have any noticeable effect?
Before I could even take the eye chill, I fell asleep. But I only slept for 4 hours, so then I woke up again and I said, okay, this is going to put me back in the mood to go to sleep. I saw no noticeable difference and wasn't able to fall asleep.
It felt like I'd had like 3 cocktails.
That's reporter Stacey Vanek-Smith. After a shot of eye chill, she slept through her alarm and the morning news meeting.
Yeah, it shouldn't be like eye chill. It's like I don't make any plans or something.
My coworkers also tried out Vacation in a Bottle, Mary Jane's Tea, and Dream Water. The results were all over the place. Avedon from UCLA's sleep clinic says there's a simpler way. Cut the caffeine, don't fall asleep to the TV, and don't take work to bed. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, if you don't care too much for money, because money can't buy you love, well then, what if it could buy you happiness? A study in tomorrow's edition of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences says the more income you have, the greater your sense of emotional well-being. Economists surveyed almost 500,000 Americans. The effect of money on happiness capped out at around $75,000 in annual income, but the overall sense of success rose the more money they made. Hint, hint, the corner office. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The U.S. markets were closed today for the Labor Day holiday. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, for Haitians starting over after the quake, opportunity might just lie elsewhere.
The young people here have learned a lot. The peasant organization helps them to get basic services, sometimes even school and jobs.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a
confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.